Good morning. Have you ever heard of Home Theater Solutions? Amazing group. HTS is your local technology expert, serving Delaware for 16 years. HTS specializes in TV installations, home automations, Sonos audio systems, security cameras, and Wi-Fi networks. For all of your home and business tech needs, give them a call, 1-800-690-2029, or visit them at htsav.net. Great group. 3, 2, 1. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Beautiful Monday morning.
It is here in beautiful Delaware.
I thought we were
lower Delaware.
I thought we were maybe going to have a little relief from the heat, but it feels like it showed back up yesterday. It was pretty hot.
Yeah, I think we'll be good in December, I think.
Here, pull this up just a little bit more.
Just a little bit more like that.
There you go.
Okay.
Do you sound better?
Yes. Yes, I think I do.
That microphone.
Oh, there we go.
We'll beat up a bit.
Yeah, that's all right.
Good morning, Doug James. So,
yes.
Fun story. Things like this happen to me very rarely, but I'm a hairdresser. I live in Delaware, obviously, and I've cut your hair a couple times. And the last time you were in, I'm like, so what do you do? Mm-hmm. And you're like, I'm the head. Well, you, what do you do?
I do a bunch of things. I always tell people when they say, what do you do? And it's taken a while. I kind of have thought, how do I say this to people? I can't say I'm a lawyer or I'm a doctor. So I always say I'm a costumer. And 90% of the time, people misunderstand and think I'm saying I'm a customer. And they want to know what I'm a customer of. You know, do you buy things professionally or something like that? And I have to explain, no, I'm a costumer. I make costumes. And if I'm sometimes, depending on the person, if I'm lucky, they let it drop right there.
Right.
But if somebody is more interested, then they say, well, what do you make costumes for? And then I can go into a little more detail, and I kind of always see if they're even vaguely interested. You know, I'll say I've made a lot of stuff for Broadway, and if they look like they're not bored yet, then I can keep going and say, and also television and film. And then, like you, they often say, well, what television have you done? And then I say, well, my main gig is Saturday Night Live. And I started out just as a wardrobe person, dresser, stitcher person back. I started in 91, and that was back when the show was a lot smaller, and it was a little more intimate, and there was just a little handful of us. And we would spend Thursday, Friday, and Saturday altering clothes, making clothes, making costumes, getting the whole show ready.
Well, hold on. Let me back you up a second because
sure.
So you, first of all, that's a big deal. A costumer. I mean, when I cut your hair, I asked you. I don't think you said you were a costumer. I thought you said you were head of wardrobe for Saturday Night Live.
Well, that was the next part.
You just dropped the bomb, and I was like, you had me at Saturday. Well, listen, I think. Listen, today, you know, anybody, you know. Working is always interesting. I think that's part of being a hairdresser is to be able to have a conversation. That's kind of what led me to podcasting. But Saturday Night Live, you said Saturday Night Live, and that opened up my whole life up until this point, because Saturday Night Live has been a thread that's run through my life for a long time. And I think a lot of this is funny too, because when you said that, so there was a lady next to me working with a client, and there was two people setting. And when you started talking, the room went quiet.
Oh, see, it's funny. I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, because everybody, for the most part, I won't say everybody, but I would say a good portion of people have grown up with Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's a very big deal. Let me just say, I appreciate it so much for coming and hanging out on my podcast and chatting about this.
Sure.
Because I think it's a huge deal. A ton of memories. I have my buddy Carlos had to create some questions so that this just.
I love that.
Yeah, well, I didn't want this to turn into be a fanboy because I have a tendency to do that. You remember, and you probably remember the skit where, what was it? Chris Farley was talking to Paul McCartney.
Oh yeah, like, yeah.
He's like, you remember that time? That's what I turn into. Yes. So we created some questions because we want to make sure that I
questions
cover
are good.
All the bases. But you almost started answering one of my first questions. I didn't even get a chance to ask you, and then Carlos will be mad. So
now go ahead. Doug James, don't want Carlos to be mad.
Thank you for coming on the RoboSocial podcast. What a great day. Thank you so much. So here we go. Please tell us about your background, education, history. How did you get the job at SNL?
Oh, gosh. It's funny how that stuff works. And a few times I've been asked to talk to like kids going into college or kids in college getting ready to come out of college. And one of the things I always talk about is when you're thinking about what you're going to do with your life, to try and be open to a lot of things. Because I had no intention of going into costumes or being a costumer or being anything like that. However, I went to college for theater, and I was an actor for a long time. Okay. Well, for a little while. I was an apprentice at a couple theaters. There's a kind of a prestigious summer theater called the Williamstown Theater Festival. And I worked there for several years, and I sort of got stuck in the costume shop. I was an intern, and I was supposed to be an acting intern, and I was in a few shows, but we were also expected to intern and to, I had to work on props, and I had to work on sets, and I had to work on lighting, and I had to work on various things, and I ended up in the costume shop. And without knowing it, apparently I was a kid, I didn't know what I was doing, but apparently somebody thought that I was pretty good, and they had a lot of people that weren't particularly very good, and I just found myself there all the time. Instead of going the next rotation where I should have gone to the set, work on sets, or I should have gone to work on props, I was still in the costume shop. I remember at one point we were doing this this play called Ring Round the Moon, and it was with Frank Langella and Blythe Danner and Mildred Dunnick and Joseph Mahar and all these, you know, kind of theater luminaries. And a very famous designer named Kerry Robbins was designing the costumes. And all of a sudden, they handed me a pile of hand-painted silk chiffon and said, "You're making Blythe Danner's dress."
Mm.
And I thought, I don't know how the hell to make Blythe Danner's dress. And the guy who was in charge of it at the time, he was Kerry Robbins' assistant, said, "I will show you, I will help you, I will do it, don't worry about it, we'll just take it step at a time, but there's nobody to do it, and I trust you to do it." And I made Blythe Danner's hand-painted silk chiffon dress. Wow. And the funny thing was that it wasn't just, it would have been one thing if it was just, oh, here's a dress and here's a simplicity pattern and you have to make it. Blythe Danner was at the time 6 months pregnant.
Uh-oh.
With her son, Luke. By the way, I was in fittings with Blythe and Gwyneth Paltrow, like 6 years old, clinging to her leg and whining about not wanting to be in the fitting and wanting to go out and play.
Is that her mother?
Yeah. Yeah, Gwyneth Paltrow's mother's blood.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about these stars and these actors, so you'll have to. I didn't realize that.
Yep. Gwyneth Paltrow's mother is Blythe Danner, and her father was Bruce Paltrow, who was a big producer.
Okay.
And but Blythe, so we had to try to hide Blythe Danner's pregnancy because the part was she was supposed to be this young virginal ballerina.
Oh.
Which doesn't work if you're 6 months pregnant.
No.
So she was wearing this Ampere dress, and we ended up kind of moving the top part of the dress. So it was literally hanging off the front of her chest just to try and hide that she was pregnant. So anyway, started.
6 months is pretty far, too.
Is pretty far. And the funny thing was, I think when rehearsal started and when they cast her, she wasn't showing very much. And they thought, oh, no big deal. We'll get through that. By the time we opened, she suddenly blossomed and was, you know, I mean, Blythe is gorgeous and she's lovely and she's a wonderful actress. And she was beautiful in the part, but she was still kind of waddling around and, you know, doing her best to not look 6 months pregnant. But so I kind of started doing that. And that was like right out of college. And right after college, I thought, well, what the hell am I going to do now? I was from Michigan. I'd gone to Eastern Michigan University. And then doing this thing in Williamstown, and there were a lot of New York people there because, you know, it's big. It's not, I'm not sure. I'm out of touch with Williamstown, so it may be as prestigious as it used to be, but it used to be a huge deal. You know, yeah. It was all movie stars. We had Christopher Reeve and Richard Chamberlain and Celeste Holmes, and, I mean, it was just stars all over the place. So several people were moving to New York, and kind of talked me into moving to New York as well. And I thought, well, moving to New York, what the hell? How hard can that be?
Right.
So I moved to New York, and I think I had a total of $200 in my pocket. That was like, yeah, that's all I had. Found an apartment in a horrible area on the Upper West Side.
So this is what year?
1976, I think.
So that was a completely different New York City.
Completely different New York City. I was, and I still have this apartment to this day.
And hopefully you pay the same rent.
We pay about the same rent. I think the landlords have hired snipers to try and pick me off as I come out the door, but they haven't gotten me yet, so I'm still there. And it's a block around the corner from the Natural History Museum, and the whole rest of the building has sold and gone co-op, and our apartment that I pay a very reasonable rent for is now listed in as-is condition at $1.3 million.
Wow.
If someone were able, if I can get out, they can get me out and they can find a buyer for it, that's what it would sell for. But anyway, found that apartment. One of the people I worked with at Williamstown had said, I know someone at Brooks Van Horn Costumes, which still existed back then. If you want, if you need work, use my name and tell them I recommended you, and you can go there and get work. And of course, I had, at the time, I thought, I have no skills. I am going to starve to death because I can't do anything. I mean, I'm terrible at math. I would be a terrible lawyer. I couldn't be a doctor. I even tried waiting tables once, and they, after one night, they asked me not to come back.
Oh, jeez.
So I started working at Brooks Van Horn, went in, used his name, they hired me, and for like almost a year, I spent sewing mirrors on elephant blankets for the Ringling Brothers Circus.
Oh, my gosh.
But ironically, and the reason I'm kind of telling you this story, why it pulls everything around, that was 76 was the year Saturday Night Live started.
Yeah.
And Saturday Night Live was a little tiny show at NBC at 30 Rock. And they didn't have a set department or a costume department or any place to build them or do any of that. So Brooks Van Horn did all the costumes for Saturday Night Live. So while I was there doing my first job of sewing mirrors on elephant blankets, I would walk by dressing rooms. I remember walking by a dressing room, and there was Lily Tomlin in a fitting for her Edith Ann ice skating costume that she wore on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And they had literally 2 days to make it, so she was going to wear it. And I remember walking by, and I kept walking, because it was right when, on the way to the bathroom or something, and, you know, from where I sat in my little corner sewing mirrors on elephant blankets. And the funny thing was that it was so difficult, because, you know, 30 Rock is at 50th and 6th, between 5th and 6th Avenue, and Brooks Van Horn was on 18th Street, down more like by 8th Avenue. So it was close, but it wasn't. The costume shop wasn't down the hall.
Right. A couple blocks.
Yeah, it was a ways. They had to schlep back and forth, and communication was harder. Well, they had completely gotten the wrong idea, and they had made this very adult, fitted Edith Ann costume, and she wanted it to make her look like a 5-year-old, And she wanted it a little exaggerated and a little, you know, she didn't want it to look like an adult costume. They had to remake it in like 3 or 4 hours.
Wow.
They had to start all over again and remake it. And I remember seeing them fitting the first one and her kind of saying, no, no, this isn't it. I'm this character. I'm this little girl. I can't.
Is this one when she was doing that, the skit where she would sit in that giant chair?
Yes, that's the character. And she'd say, and that's the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and she'd do things like, there's a character where she'd do things like, you know, Mom had her friends over for tea the other day, and one of the ladies said, I love those little tuna fish sandwiches. And I said, Kitty likes them too. He ate three when she was walking on the table. And, you know, stuff like that. And
yeah.
That's Edith Ann. So I was aware of Saturday Night Live from my first month in New York and my first job there at
so that the first Brooks the Van first Horn. Cast was what? It was John Belushi.
First cast was John Belushi, and the first cast was long before me because the show started in 76. I didn't go to the show till 91. So, but I was kind of this weird kind of close to it, you know,
right,
during these years. And it was John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, Jane Curtin, of course, Gilda Radner, the Lorraine Newman, I think Chevy Chase, who is that Garrett Morris?
Yes.
The black comedian who was, you know, great. One of the first times that, you know, back, and you think just 76 doesn't seem that long ago. And it seems so that it was so unusual for someone to hire a black comedian,
right.
You know, it's like, but there he was, which was great. Let's see. It was that little small cast.
I think that was it.
Yeah, that was kind of it. And I remember hearing, because my boss had been there since just about the beginning. And I remember them saying that there was no money, there was no space, there was no time. They barely had costumes. They hadn't figured out the whole concept of doing fast changes in a live show.
Right.
So they tried to design it where they would just maybe change their shirts or they just throw something over what they already had on, and they would put towels down on the floor and they would line up along the wall and change their costumes, and their other costumes would be laying in piles on the floor and stuff like that. So
it was a tough times, but not tough, but you know, it was a hustle.
It was a hustle, and they hadn't figured it out yet. I mean, they've had, 70 to now is 45. I think I've been there through the 25th anniversary show and the 25th anniversary? Yeah, I think the 25th anniversary show, and we did the 30th anniversary. I've done a bunch of anniversary
You've
shows.
You've been there for a lot of anniversaries.
For a lot of anniversaries, yeah.
Well, I was born in, I was born in 68, so it was 76 when it started?
76 was when the show started.
Yeah, so I remember as a little kid watching Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was in college.
Yeah, well,
so,
you look good.
Makes me feel, I don't know how old
you are, but you look good.
I am 68,
I hope I look good at 68 like you.
Well, thank you. And as all the people out there listening to this podcast can tell that I look good too.
Yes, so, I witnessed.
I think it goes through the air and
good living.
Yeah, exactly. Good, clean living and oof.
Well, it is a, when I think about Saturday Night Live, I mean, my memories just go everywhere. I mean, it's from like as a kid, as a young, you know, middle schooler, as a high schooler, as a young adult. I mean, it's always, you know, there's portions of my life and I think about, you know, the cast of what was going on. Of Saturday Night Live. So, how has costuming and wardrobing changed over the last 30 years? So you mentioned that they were like, they didn't have it really figured out. Throwing everything. So what has changed? I guess
it's
becoming
just
more efficient.
Yeah, and I think just in general, people, and that happens. I think that happens in every field. You know, like in medicine, they start out finding cures and treatments for various things, and they've all over just in the last 20 years, everything has gotten better, more refined, faster, more effective, all those kinds of things. And I think the same thing with costuming. It's funny, we were flipping around, you know, in this age of COVID, and we're stuck indoors, and we're watching TV a lot. And we've now like watched everything that has ever been produced for TV in the last 3 weeks. We've watched all of it.
Pretty much.
So last night we were flipping around and we started watching the movie The Beastmaster from 1970-something.
Some muscles.
Some muscles. And of course, I can't watch anything without looking at the costumes.
Right.
I can't, even if I try, I can't stare at the way it's been made and what the seams are. And I was, you know, and the costumes were pretty good, but I thought, I remember the movie. And I remember thinking this movie is really cool and this looks really good and the clothes were kind of impressive and the sets were impressive. And I look at it now and compared to what we do now, it looks pretty cheesy. You know, it looks kind of cheesy.
Well, we had Jaws Fest. I don't know if you went, but they did Jaws Fest over at Hudson Fields.
Oh, yeah, I didn't go, but I heard about it,
And we were talking about our favorite scenes, and my favorite scene was when that leg comes floating down.
Oh, yeah,
the guy gets his leg cut off. And I remember as a kid going, oh, my God, there's a leg from
and
a body.
It is real.
It's real right there.
Yeah.
And my son, who's 14, watched Jaws, and he said, it's kind of slow. Because over the time since 78 or 76 when that movie came out, you know, we've seen many legs now come off, bodies blown up, machine gun guts, blood everywhere. Our expectations have just...
We know how to do it now.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so now it's like the next level. I mean, I'm glad I'm not in that business. Can you imagine the...
Oh, it is... It is hard. There have been times when we have done, one of the big things lately is us doing royal, because there have been a lot of royal weddings lately.
Right.
You know, I mean, even since Princess Di, there was, Kate Middleton, and there have been all those things. So we've done on SNL these royal wedding sketches. Mm. You know, usually the sketches are like the after party at Kate Middleton's wedding, or... We did the after party at Harry and Meghan's wedding.
Yeah.
And what happens is that, because we only have 3 days to do the whole show. We have Thursday, they spend Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday writing. Monday they get together, they have a big meeting with Lauren. Everyone gets together and they introduce the new host. And all the actors and the writers are expected to just throw out ideas for sketches. Just pop out ideas. They're kind of asked to be thinking about it beforehand, throw out some ideas. What about if, the host is The Rock, and what if he's a superhero and his tight split? And Lauren will say, that sounds funny, work on that. And during that meeting, they kind of try and hone down what they're going to do. You know, through all these vague, rough ideas, they say, Lauren and the other producers kind of say, I don't think that's feasible, but work on that. And that's not feasible, you know, and they let them do a whole lot of stuff. And they have Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday to write. Then Wednesday, late in the afternoon or Wednesday evening, they have a read-through. And, of course, up to this time, none of us are there. Sets, props, costumes, lights. My boss will come in for the read-through just so that he can hear what's going on. He has an idea of what might be coming at us, and he can do whatever he might need to do to prepare. But otherwise, we're off doing whatever else we have to do, because Saturday Night Live for us is really kind of a part-time job.
Yeah, that's what you said, and I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, 20 shows a year, and we only work 3 days a week, so technically I really only work 60, and depending on if we have a special or something, 60 to 65, 70 days a year on SNL. So that leaves the rest of the time with me looking for other work. They do that. Then Wednesday they do the reading, and they'll read maybe... 30 sketches, 30, 35 sketches.
Ideas.
There'll be fully written sketches.
So do all the writers, and I don't know how any of this works. This is great to learn. So do all the writers spend Monday and Tuesday and then Wednesday writing, and then they put them all in front of Lauren and he picks?
They all sit around a big table. They go into the read-through room and sit around a big table, and And by then, I mean, on Monday, Lauren has probably said, well, that sketch sounds like, if it's this writer that had the idea for the sketch, or a lot of the actors write and have ideas for sketches. Matter of fact, the actors that do the best are the ones that have, that really are good at coming up with ideas and are good at driving the writing of sketches.
Someone told me that, I saw it on somewhere, that basically the host really is, he runs the show.
He can.
He can.
It's very fluid because it depends on the host. There are hosts like I remember Ray Mermano coming in, and he came in to host the show. He's done it a couple times, I think. And, funny, great, talented, amazing guy. And he brought a team of writers with him.
Okay.
They were people he'd worked with. He liked them. He had ideas. He came with completely pre-written sketches. And they just kind of said, hey, if that's what you want, fine, let's work them in. And some of them worked and some of them didn't.
Okay.
And sometimes I think they would say, well, let's have one of our writers work with your writers on making that sketch, bumping it up a little bit. So it can work like that. We can have people that come in that do not write at all, and have really no interest in writing, have no concept. Betty White, who was just, amazing I remember at the time when the last time she hosted, she would go around telling people, I'm 84 and a half.
That was a skit.
That was just in person. I think she even worked it in a couple times. But everyone assumed that she's 84, she's Betty White, she was in every single sketch she made. She did every single thing we wanted her to do. She did every pre-tape, she did every rehearsal, she did everything. They did not go light on her at all, and she didn't miss a beat.
That's awesome.
She's awesome. People like Betty White, she's not particularly interested in. She may have had some ideas. I don't know all of this stuff. But there are people like Ray Romano came in. They really just tailor each show to who's coming in and how much input they want to have, how much input they're really able to have. And if they really don't have any, then our actors and our writers kick in and provide it all. And if they have ideas, I think there have been times when, can't remember any names, which is probably really good, that people have come in with really specific ideas that didn't work at all.
Yeah.
And
so do you have to, or not you, but do they have to, do they let them go with it? Or do they say, listen, maybe let's try something different?
They're pretty good about that. They'll let them try. Because the show doesn't, just in terms of what's amazing about the show, it's amazing good and amazing bad at the same time, is that I feel like Lauren has, the show is so successful and it's such an icon, that I think Lauren is confident that he just wants to do anything he wants to do.
Right.
So if he said, I want a sketch with 20 elephants and the Taj Mahal, then he would just say, I want a sketch with 20 elephants and the Taj Mahal, and we would have to figure out how to do it. There's a certain amount of, well, we really kind of can't do that, but then there would be a meeting of the minds of, but how can we come as close as we possibly can to that? If that's what Lauren wants, or if that's what somebody wants. Like, for instance, if one of our head writers, if he really had written a sketch that was really expensive and difficult to do, and maybe wasn't as funny as it might have been, and might have been cut, because it's the head writer, they might push it through and do it anyway, just to give him the benefit of the doubt and try it. I remember we did a sketch once, and it was Seth Meyers and Amy Poehler doing something called Little Sleuths. And they were two kids who were like Sherlock Holmes. They did it a few times, and it never quite worked. And the two of them are adorable and funny and crazy, but that sketch never quite worked. And they did one where it was in a big Victorian house. And the other thing that we can get into is that when the show happens, write the show Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Thursday, we start working on the show. And these days, Thursday is when we start doing pre-tapes. So Thursday, and in the old days, we would occasionally do a fake commercial, but the rest of the show was live. Well, I think, I can't remember when it started. I think it was with Chris Parnell and Andy Samberg did a kind of this rap song about going to see the Narnia movie.
I saw it.
Do you remember that?
Oh my God.
Remember that? Yeah. That
classic.
Was just classic.
Yeah.
That was something they had gone to see the Narnia movie and they had started kind of fooling around and riffing off on this thing. And they said, hey, we should tape this. Well, they went to Lauren and said, well, you know, we have this idea. We want to do this little tape. Well, there was no time. There was no money. No one had thought of any of this. They gave them like a camera and a couple hours to go out and wander around the city. There was no budget. There was no planning. They just did it. And then it came on the show and was kind of a hit. And they realized, oh, wow. And then they started doing things like the Laser Cats stuff.
I remember it.
Yeah. They created their own kind of little mini unit, film unit, to do those things. But they had no money and no time and no budget. And there was like a separate costume designer, Brian Hemiseth, who was brilliant and incredibly talented, but had no time and no money and was doing it all by himself, which is one of the reasons why all the costumes looked like, you know, tinfoil helmets and all that kind of stuff. That literally was, that's what the look they wanted, but it all was also what the time and the money allowed.
Right.
And so as soon as that started getting successful, a whole film unit was created. And suddenly money was starting to be filtered toward it, and attention and crews, and a whole unit exists. And these days, we spend all of Thursday, we'll do three or four, like, entire film-worthy film pieces for each show. And those are done in the same five-day window.
Jeez.
And we have Thursday to get ready. Usually they'll start shooting those film pieces Thursday night and they'll shoot them into Friday. And we have Thursday and Friday to just work on film pieces. And because these days they do that so much, Friday tech rehearsals, which are like blocking rehearsals for lighting and for cameras and stuff like that,
right.
We use stand-ins because all the actors are off doing the film pieces.
Right.
So they don't come back usually till Friday night, if we're lucky. And then Friday night is when we start the whole rest of the show for the next day.
Well, that's the kind of, that chaos is kind of what's great about the show, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Because you couldn't say, well, let's work on some of this stuff a week ahead of the week, because then it would start to get really, you know, because I've always thought the funniest thing about Saturday Night Live is just that, you know, that amateur, sometimes it has that amateur
exactly,
look to it.
Exactly.
And, you know, they start laughing or, you know, it's whoever the guest
weird,
is.
These days, it's that weird juxtaposition between we threw this together and you can tell, or we've gotten really good at this and we threw it together and it looks like a movie.
Right.
You know, like we did not too long ago, they did a sketch. You may remember this. They did Family Feud with one family being the Game of Thrones characters and the other family being the Marvel Avengers characters.
I did not see this.
You're going to have to YouTube it. The funny thing, though, is that it was written last minute. So we didn't have any time. And so
Who was the host? Was it a Steve Harvey character or was it just...
Who was the host for that?
Because he's funny, too.
Oh, he's hysterical.
He flirts with kind of like, you know, be careful, Steve Harvey.
Yes. Yeah, well, that Keenan does the Steve Harvey character, and he's so brilliant at it. And, you know, because Keenan kind of loves Steve Harvey because he's such a, you know, he's such a broad
guy. I can't imagine. Who was the guy that did it back in our day? Remember the guy that kissed everybody? He was the host. Remember, like in the 80s, 70s, 80s.
Oh, the guy that kissed everybody.
Richard Dawson?
Oh, the game show host. Yes, Richard Dawson. Richard Dawson. Yeah.
I don't remember. Maybe you do. I can't imagine that it would have been. It seems it would have been a funny skit to do something like on Richard Dawson back in
those
days.
Right.
Maybe there even was.
Well, we
at
do.
The time.
You know, they love game show sketches. So we're constantly doing game show sketches.
Well, Richard Dawson was like, you couldn't. He, you know, how many people did he kiss? I mean, he was a kisser.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody.
You couldn't do that today.
No, you kind of couldn't. People would just think it was a little creepy, where back then, you know, everybody, all the moms at home said, oh, isn't that great? Look at he's so sweet.
I don't remember if there was ever a Saturday Night Live skit on Richard Dawson, but.
No, but I bet he was kind of like, you know, he was in there with all the game show hosts mm-hmm. that we've done.
Someone used to do the Patsy or the guy from Love Connection shaking the wrist.
Oh, yeah.
That was a fun one.
Yeah, we did that. So we, lots of game shows. so anyway, what was I talking about?
Oh, you were talking about the, doing the, with the Avengers and the.
Oh, yeah. So the thing about that was that they wanted Game of Thrones and the Avenger movies are known for. Those costumes, I mean, the whole physical, the costumes, the cinematography, the effects, the locations, all those things are amazing on those shows.
Right.
And fortunately, we had already done a Melisande costume for the Seth Meyers show. Matter of fact, I made it. And so we were able to pull that from our stock. We had a stock of Game of Thrones things because Game of Thrones has been so popular.
Right.
We kept doing Game of Thrones sketches. But of course, did they use the costumes? We said, well, we've got all of this. And they said, no, we don't want those characters. We want new ones. But we were able to do the Melisande thing, but then we had to make from scratch all the other ones. And I'm trying to remember who they were, but it was all the
complicated Game of Thrones. I mean, the Avengers to me would be. Seem to be the really the tough ones.
And the Avengers
Iron
things,
Man and
we did, who was it? All I remember is we did what's the main character in the new movie, the guy that destroys everything.
Thaddeus?
Thanos. We had to do him. And they had to, the makeup department had to do a silicone muscle body for him.
Oh, geez.
An entire silicone face prosthetic makeup that was blue, and then we had to copy that costume exactly. But the thing was, they wrote this late. We didn't get to start on it until Friday night before the show. So we started building these Game of Thrones things and the Avengers things the night before, and they looked pretty good.
Will you work all night? Will you pull all-nighters?
We have in the past.
Okay.
We've gotten to a point where they realize that it's not a good idea if we can help it, because we all have to be there at 8:30 Saturday morning, and we're there till 2 in the morning, Sunday morning.
Wow.
Straight. Because we do tech rehearsals all morning. Noon, in the morning, they're prepping things, doing finishing stuff. Then at noon, the tech rehearsals start for each sketch. Then we break there is no real lunch break. You just grab anything you can eat whenever you can eat it. Then there's a quick dinner break right there in the building. They won't let us leave, which is smart of them, because we'd probably all go
never
screaming off. We'd never come back. And then there's an 8 o'clock dress rehearsal show. With a full audience, a full show, and it's a full show with everything that they've written that we're doing. And it's usually a 2 hour to 2 hour and 20 minute show.
Wow.
For a live audience. We do the whole show, the live audience leaves, the show's usually over by 10 or 10:30. Then we have an hour and a half till 11:30, the live show, they have a meeting, and they make cuts. The show has to be cut down to an hour and a half.
Right.
So they will cut anywhere from 3 to 5 complete sketches. They will rewrite things to make them tighter and slightly shorter. And they have even been known to cut film unit pieces if they thought this just doesn't work. You know, this was a good idea. We thought it was a good idea. We're not crazy about it. It's not working. We're just going to cut it. Now, sometimes shelve it. and then maybe re-edit it and work in a different host.
Okay.
And then show the film piece again and try it again. So then we have an hour and a half to rework everything. And then the show goes up live at 11:30. Fingers crossed, everything goes well, because it is live. It's funny, one of the big questions people always ask me is, like, when do they tape that show? And I say, well, it's Saturday Night Live, and it's live. What's confusing, I think, is that we only do 20 shows a year, and which means that we'll do 2 to 3 shows a month. But generally, we'll do 2 shows. Our schedule will be 2 shows on, and then maybe 1 week off. And then we'll do another 2 shows, and then maybe there'll be 2 weeks off. And then we'll do 3 shows in a row, and then have a week off. Well, all those week offs, you're seeing reruns.
Right.
Those are the times you're seeing reruns. And the other interesting thing that most people, I think, don't quite realize is when you're seeing a show live on Saturday, when this is a live show, then you are seeing a live show. If, you know, someone slips and says the F word, you're going to hear it.
I've ever heard anybody say the F word on Saturday Night Live.
What was her name? This is terrible because she's a fabulous comedian and she's absolutely adorable and we loved her on the show. But she was doing a sketch where her character was continuing.
Janet Jackson.
No, it wasn't Janet.
Cork Soakers.
No, well, that was another one.
I want to talk about that one because that had some. Go ahead.
Oh, but anyway, she had this character where she was saying flipping, you know, oh, the flipping thing, and this is the flipping thing, and the flip. It was something like flip. It was really close to the F word, and she slipped on live camera and actually said the F word once. Uh-oh. And it got through, and she did that one season and then didn't come back. but she's had a great career since. But that's the kind of thing that can happen in a live show. Now, the thing is, when you see that show again, when they rerun it, you will not see that. Because the second a live show is done, you will never see that show again. Because that show is taken off and edited. And they will take clips sometimes even from the 8 o'clock show. If they, and it's not sinister or anything. It's like if they look at the show as a complete thing and they think, did this sketch work better at 8 o'clock? If it worked better at 8 o'clock, we'll just cut in the footage from that.
Right.
And if somebody says the wrong thing, we'll just edit it out and edit stuff in. So when you're seeing a live show, you're really seeing a live show. Every other time you're seeing a kind of cleaned up, edited, tightened up version of the show.
What happens to the, so there's one audience that comes in for the 8 o'clock version, mm-hmm. and then they leave.
They leave.
And they get a new audience.
Yep, they leave, and there's about an hour, 2 hours, and there's a whole nother audience lined up in the, you know, in the ground floor of Rockefeller, waiting to take the elevators up to the 8th floor to see the 11 o'clock show, the 11:30 show.
Well, that's crazy.
Yeah,
the live part of Saturday Night Live has always been the unknown, what's going to happen, like with that, the Cork Soakers.
Yes, yes.
The Janet Jackson skit where she struggles. It's funny. It's clearly live. Mm-hmm. But what am I, and I know this part, I don't know, when we talked earlier, you said you don't really have a lot of interaction with the musical guests. But the musical guests, to me, has always been one of the great things about Saturday Night Live because, you know, and times have changed. But this used to be, in the 80s and in the 90s, you know, there was not a lot of options to see a musical act unless you went to their concert.
Right, right.
So
exactly.
To see a band like, and I asked you this, and my buddy Carlos and I, we do a Pearl Jam podcast, but when Pearl Jam played on Saturday Night Live, that was one of the first opportunities we had to see them, like, because it was hard to, you know, we didn't have YouTube, we didn't mm-hmm, have Instagram, mm-hmm. we didn't have
right,
Twitter.
Right.
You didn't have a lot of options to see music.
Right, right.
So every weekend, I set my VCR. I used to tape Cops and Saturday Night Live, and I would go out, right. and I would come home, and I would rewatch it on, you know, on the VCR. But, you know, like I saw Smashing Pumpkins and Pearl Jam, just all these great bands that would come on Saturday Night Live. And still, to this day, I mean, a lot of great bands get to come on Saturday.
Oh, a lot of great bands. And it's funny because we are, I can only speak for the costume department. Well, I can kind of speak for, because sets and lights have a lot more interaction with the band than we do, of course.
Right.
The band is used to touring, and most of the bands have their own stylist.
Right.
Even if it's just like a stylist that says, oh, wear that T-shirt tonight. You know, let you wear that one and you wear the blue one. You know, it can go anywhere from that to really just stylists that are doing like expensive, high-end designer things for these people that you would look at and not really think of it as expensive high-end, but it looks cool, you know. So if they need something, they will come to us and say, we bought this, we wanted him to wear it, but it doesn't fit. Can you, you know, can you hem the pants? Can you let it out? Can you take it in? And we will absolutely say, absolutely, we'll do whatever you need. And we do that from time to time. But most of the time they come, they've been touring, they know what they're going to wear.
Yeah.
You know, they have their clothes. They have a stylist that's been, they're off performing in other places. So sure. They're just coming and doing their gig here. The sets and light people will do a more intense thing
right.
with them. And it depends on the band. There are bands that come in and they're like, you know, we're just here. We're going to play our music. You do whatever you want around us.
Right.
You know. So that's what also makes it interesting is you never know each week it's completely different, and I kind of like the fact that that we technically don't have a huge amount of input into the band because that means that we haven't kind of blended the band to fit in with our show. You know, they are completely their own thing, you
right.
know, and we haven't made any other than doing what they ask. We haven't made any artistic influence on them at all. You know, they are there to do what their thing is. And if that, and that's, I think, what makes the band stand kind of alone and really stand out in the show.
Let's see. So do you have any SNL favorites that you work with or have worked with that stand out?
Oh, gosh. Cast members or hosts
anything? Yeah, I would imagine cast members.
Well, I think I told you this before. For I have the last few years, I have, I'm technically, it's sort of a title, and it's why my name is in the credits on the show, if the credits ever have a chance to roll.
Right.
No, most of the time, there's no time, and they're not there. I'm the assistant head of wardrobe, which means I'm just my boss's first guy. I'm his assistant. But we've really, we don't even think about that very much because we've become such a, us costume people, the ones that, there's a small group of us that are there Thursday, Friday, and Saturday that alter things, make things, figure it all out, do all that kind of stuff. Then on Saturday, all the other dressers come in because every cast member has his own dresser. They have to because if there are fast changes, you need at least one person there to help you get into that. And each actor's dresser is not only just responsible for dressing them, they're responsible for studying the show, figuring out what sketches each person is in, what they have to wear in each sketch, how much time they have between the sketches, figuring out, okay, this really is a fast change. Where are we going to do it? That's the dresser's responsibility. And we have places, little places all over the set. If there's no time to literally, so that they can literally run a few feet off the set, a few feet off camera, rip all their clothes off, put the new clothes on, their new clothes on, and they're surrounded by their dresser, their hair person, and their makeup person,
wow.
all working on them at the same time, and then shoving them back to where they, and sometimes grabbing them, knowing where they have to go next, grabbing them by the hand, and running over to the next set, because it's so chaotic. Sometimes, most of the time, the actors have figured that out. The hosts don't. The host dresser, Donna, she literally once carried I can't remember who it was, but someone, the floor was so crowded and they needed to get her fast to the next set, which was it. She jumped on her back and she carried her to the next set just to get through the cameras moving and the set people moving and the crew moving sets and the props people and the lighting people and the sound people. And
is it pretty chaotic?
It's incredibly chaotic. And there are, as you can see, there's the floor, the audience on the floor. And then there's always a ring of people watching right behind that audience. And sometimes they're entourage from the stars. Sometimes they're, a lot of times it's like dressers like me who are standing there waiting for the sketch to finish so I or whoever the dresser is can run in, grab the person, drag them to where their clothes are, rip their clothes off, put their new clothes on, and shove them back to where they need to be. So it's incredibly chaotic.
Well, you see that at the end. Like, you'll see a skit, and then it'll kind of go to commercial, and the cameras will back away and pan out. And you'll see everybody run in.
You'll see everybody run in. Apart. Yep. That's exactly. They do that on purpose because that's real. I mean, that really is what we're doing.
Well, we wanted to ask you, you know, so the Will Ferrell, you know, the
cowbell.
The cowbell skit, which was hysterical. I don't even know. That was Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
I guess. Was mm-hmm. Was that the same? So was Colonel Angus, was that the same night as?
Oh, gosh. Christopher Walken has hosted so many times. I can't remember if that was the same night. It might have been.
What a great night. Because you had more cowbell.
Yeah.
And then Colonel Angus.
Colonel Angus. And then do you remember the what was it called? I think the Cosmopolitan, where he was the kind of sleazy bachelor, and everything was from the viewpoint of the young lady he was trying to seduce, who was really a cameraman. And you would just see a gloved hand with a ring on it.
Yes. And he was talking
right to the camera as though it's a beautiful young lady.
Yes.
Well, the funny thing was, that was one of our cameramen using, you know, a handheld camera, but he would have to wear a long glove with a diamond bracelet and a ring on it. And sometimes he would have to wear a dress with like high heels if the camera panned down and as though he was looking at his feet or something, because it was all from the viewpoint of the girl that was trying to get away from the sleazy guy seducing her.
Well, I wanted to ask you, was that what was the decision for Will Ferrell's half shirt? Because shirt, I don't know if it was a half shirt or just kept riding up, but it was
A tight classic 70s shirt. And in true Will Ferrell style, I think they just picked this tight 70s shirt for him. And he started rehearsing. And Will, any chance he gets, he will show his body.
Without any shame.
Without any shame, knowing that his body is kind of funny,
yeah.
You know, because he was just pudgy enough and just out of shape enough that it was just funny.
Right.
And so I think, if I remember right, what happened is found a tight vintage 70s shirt, put it on him. He started rehearsing, and because it was tight and because he has, you know, a bit of a pot belly, it started riding up. And he may have asked us to make it a little bit shorter. So then we probably made it a little bit shorter, and then he took every advantage to raise his arms over his head, have the shirt pop up, where because of his little pot belly, it just stayed, and the rest is history. I don't know if you remember, there was a sketch where it was an office meeting, and the discussion was they had been told that they could wear patriotic things to work if they wanted to. Like, if they wanted to wear a patriotic flag tie, they could wear one. And in terms of dress code for this very conservative office. So Will, of course, arrived in a cropped T-shirt with an American flag on it.
Oh, geez.
And American flag tiny running shorts.
Oh, boy.
With everything hanging out. And the funny thing was, you know, we rehearsed in it, and he said, can you make these smaller? So we took the waist off the shorts, took it down an inch or so, you know, made them a little more like hip huggers. We took an inch off the leg and made the legs a little shorter, and the legs were slit up the sides a little bit. And then the air show comes, and he's rolled the waist down, And he's rolled the legs up, so it looks like he's wearing a tiny Speedo.
Jeez.
Which no one knew he was going to do. And again, the rest is history. And then, of course, the
whole
thing.
I don't know if I saw that one.
Yeah, I think
you could
probably. I think it did. Yeah, yeah. And the whole thing was everyone else is in conservative suits and ties and things, and they're saying, "Well, what are you wearing?" And he said, "Well, you said we could wear patriotic attire."
Yeah.
And he's reaching over people and standing up and, you know, bending over with his butt in people's faces and, you know, the whole.
He's hysterical.
Usual.
Well, and
stuff.
That whole, you know, the Colonel Angus. I mean,
and the Colonel Angus. Yeah.
That. And
that was Tina
Soakers.
Fey, I think. That Tina Fey wrote that, I think, or was one of the writers of that. And
hysterical,
it's very Tina.
But
humor.
That had like some costumes because
it was all Southern
stuff.
Plantation stuff.
Yeah.
When we do stuff like that, every time we do big period sketches, we rent the stuff.
Okay,
and we can rent. We have had things flown from England overnight because they have better stock of
period
costumes,
stuff, yeah.
Or we'll have things sent overnight from California. There used to be big East Coast costume companies, and there just aren't anymore. And so all that stuff was rented, and then we alter it, repair it, retrim it, you know, do everything. But we can have like racks and racks and racks of clothes for sketches like that.
Different things. Well, and then the cork soakers.
Yeah, yeah.
That was
yeah.
more period stuff, kind of that old Italy.
Yes, yes.
Funny, though. Oh, my God. We were... I'm sorry. This is kind of the fanboy part of me.
Yeah.
Where those are some of the classic skits.
Classic thing. Well, talking of classics, the Sweaty Balls thing
gosh,
with Shwe- Alec and...
It's so
Alec
uncomfortable to
and
watch
Anna
that.
Gasteyer and... Who was Alec and Anna and Molly.
Yeah.
Alec and Anna and Molly did that. And it's, just... I remember just, and Colonel Angus was really a spinoff of Sweaty Balls. The whole wordplay that sounds, you know, it's attempting to be innocent, but sounds like something that's really.
That was a question I was going to have. How many, you know, it seems like a lot of the funnier skits are that kind of that wordplay, like cork soakers.
Right, exactly.
You know, and Janet Jackson during that episode is like, "So how long have you been a cock? I mean, coke soaker." Yeah, it's a twist.
That's the whole point. And as much as they kind of say that they frown on people breaking up or frown on people, you know, Lorne ideally, I think, really likes it when they just can really do it straight faced and get through it. And of course, but Jimmy Fallon, for instance, was
hysterical.
Just known for breaking up over things like that and just not being able to hold it in. And we love that,
yeah.
You know, we all love it when they break up because then we break up and it's like Rachel doing Debbie Downer.
Yeah.
You know, there people would be like breaking up all over the place. And then Rachel would be really, really
good. Is that
good,
the schoolgirl?
She's the Rachel Dratch, and she's Debbie Downer, who every they're at like some party and everyone else is being light. And she's talking about her cat having feline AIDS or something. Oh, and, geez. You know, and everything is kind of a downer. And so.
What about Pat?
Oh, Pat, that was. I was there for Pat. It's funny. There's several things because I didn't come till 91. So there are things I wasn't there for, and there are lots of things I was there for.
Well, we talked about. I mean, you weren't there for Landshark, but honestly, to me, that is really.
I think we did a couple Landsharks when I was there, but I wasn't there for the creation of Landshark.
You were to me you were there at the really the best part. I mean, 90s.
I think so. Yeah.
I mean, that's when Dana Carvey.
Church Lady,
Wayne's World, all that. That
yeah,
was
all
some
those
of
guys.
The best.
All those guys.
Some of the best freaking times. I mean. There wasn't a Saturday Night Live that I didn't tape or watch back then. I'm not as good at it anymore.
It's hard. We have, you know, we don't realize how much choice we have these days. Back then, there wasn't a whole lot of choice. I mean, we didn't have taped stuff. You could maybe go out and buy VHS tapes and stuff if you wanted to, but they were expensive. You couldn't DVR things. You could, you know, you had to you had to stay up till 11:30 and watch it if you wanted to watch it.
Well, you could videotape it.
Yeah, I guess we could. We could videotape it.
I definitely videotaped it. I mean, Saturday Night Cops and Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Always watched them.
They're
And yeah, and for some reason, well, and so recently, I think it's probably been a little while, but Eddie Murphy came back.
Oh, for, you mean this past year?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. That's because I was semi-retired and I wasn't supposed to work this past year, and then they kind of talked me into working. So, and I realized, you know, I really like it. And so I said, okay, I'll come back. And but the one show I didn't do was Eddie Murphy.
Oh.
The last year. And I did every show. I mean, in 29 years, I've missed two shows. And the one show was Eddie Murphy this past year, partially because it was the Christmas show. And everything was kind of crazy and everything. And I thought of all the shows that, and I was kind of coming back and forth here to Delaware. And I thought, oh, do I really want to be kind of coming back to Delaware on the day before Christmas Eve,
right,
you know, and figure out the trains and the deal with all of that stuff. And my boss had kind of said, you know, if you come back, then you don't have to do every show. If there are things you need to miss or something, you can. So I just picked that show thinking, well, and also it's Eddie Murphy. And Eddie Murphy is, now ultimately they said he was totally fine, but he does can have a reputation for being kind of crazy and difficult. And so on top of the timing, I thought this could be a really hard show. So
yeah.
So that just made me think, I as much as I hate to do it, I'm going to just miss the show.
Well, without throwing anybody under a bus, but, you know, have you had a favorite show or something that really stood out as really a great time and maybe without, you know, nobody getting hurt feelings over this, obviously, but, you know,
no.
Has there been other shows that have been like, oh, that was a little stressful?
There have been a few hosts that, well, I think I can say a little bit because it's been public knowledge that there are hosts that the show has not been super happy with and will probably not ask back.
Uh-oh.
One, I think that, really very few. Because most of the people, even if there's someone that was on the show and there were problems or things didn't quite work or something like that, it's usually not because they were a problem. It's just because they usually, very few hosts come on and want to make trouble or don't want to make it work and don't want to make it be a success. They all want to come on. Some are just better at it. Some have more experience doing live stuff. We have a lot of film actors that are used to working in little, small, closed sets, doing take after take after take till they get it, till they feel comfortable. The idea of you're in front of this live audience with stuff whizzing around you, you know, potentially distracting you, and then trying to figure out what I do next, where I go next, it's kind of overwhelming. It will probably not be a surprise that one of the people that was not universally embraced was Kevin Spacey. Just to throw a name out there.
So embraced by the crowd or by the people or just wasn't into it?
The crowd, I think the show was good enough. And he's incredibly talented, you know. The issue is he can be very imperious and demanding and incredibly destructively critical. So I think by the time the show happened, he had kind of alienated most of the cast, most of the writers, most of the producers, and now a lot of this, I feel like I would not be my place to talk about because I'm in wardrobe. In earlier years when the show was smaller, I would often have fittings with cast people, with hosts, and deal with them a lot in person. Lately, they've gotten much more protective of the hosts. So their own people will fit them. And then they'll bring the clothes to us and say, here are the pins. This is what we want done. And then we kind of have to do it. There are times when we say, this would be a lot easier if we could see it on them. But they've just gotten very protective of people, understandably. Kevin would do things. I would watch Kevin in rehearsals. Because in our room, in our wardrobe room, as we're working all day long, there's a big monitor, and we see every minute of rehearsal that's going on. So it's very helpful to us to know, okay, in this sketch, they're wearing this costume, but they're really standing, we're seeing their right shoulder, we never see them on the other side. For some, that might be good to know. I don't have to worry so much about that. Oh, they're sitting down. We never really see their pants, or we never see their skirt. Doesn't mean we won't fix them. We just don't have to hyperventilate over it. We don't have to anal neurotic over something we're not really going to see on camera. And we can't rely on other people giving us that information. So if we're working constantly watching rehearsals, then we can see what's going on. So I was watching. We were all watching the Kevin Spacey rehearsals, as we would do all of them. And he would be like snapping his fingers and barking orders at people and calling people amateurs and inept. And it was, he would get frustrated if things didn't happen. And he had done the show before, but still he was kind of used to doing film and other things. It's tough. I mean, it's... I can see on
some level. Not a lot of humility.
Yeah. And also everybody has a different threshold of frustration and stuff. And sometimes people are perfectionists. And although we, in a show that's in a 2-hour primetime show that's being produced in 3 days, we do a pretty amazing job and we get a lot done. We are not a movie that, has 3 months to prepare and has to figure everything out and 3 months to storyboard and figure every camera shot out and all those kinds of things.
Well, I mean, Saturday Night Live is a great, it is what it is, but you'll see a lot of people do the show that are doing stuff. It's like part of almost a campaign. We're going to do this interview. We're going to do this interview. We're going to be on this magazine. We're going to be on Saturday Night Live. So it's usually something promoting.
It's a well thought out thing. And I don't know if a lot of people realize this, that you'll notice that when someone's hosting Saturday Night Live, they're generally always a main guest on the Jimmy Fallon Tonight Show.
Right.
Jimmy Fallon we're on 8th floor, Jimmy Fallon's on the 6th floor. They just have to walk down some stairs and go do, so they usually go do his show in the middle of rehearsing our show. Seth Meyers is down the hall. So, and I've worked on both those shows.
What's Seth Meyers' show?
The Late Night with Seth Meyers.
I don't see. That's how old I am. I can't stay up that late anymore.
It's like Jimmy Fallon is now the Tonight Show, of course.
Right, yep.
And Seth Meyers' show comes on right after him.
Who was doing that show? That wasn't.
It was. I think
Kevin George.
It
Kevin
was.
James?
Well, Jimmy took over for Conan O'Brien.
Where'd Conan go?
Conan was doing the Tonight Show, and for some reason they just didn't feel it was working, and they just shuffled him off the show. He's now off doing his own show on TBS
the Conan O'Brien show.
Right,
okay.
But Conan O'Brien used to be the Tonight Show.
Okay.
And then they replaced Conan with Jimmy, and that's just downstairs from us. And Seth Meyers is the show that's afterward, and that used to be Late Night with someone else, and it's terrible, I can't remember who it is. If I hear the name, I'm probably go, of course, that's who it is. It's now Late Night with Seth Meyers, who comes on right after the Tonight Show.
Well, even back in Johnny Carson. I mean, back when we were younger, I mean, those shows all had that feeling of it, just like, let's meet the star kind of show. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But now they've all kind of turned into just one part of a three-pronged attack of an ad campaign of something they're promoting, whether it's a movie or something. So,
well, most of the stars are there because they make. They get paid, but I think they get paid a little small nominal amount.
Right.
They are there ostensibly to promote something.
To promote
and they'll
something.
Even say, I'm here because I'm in the next something movie. You know, I'm doing the next Avengers movie. I'm in the next thing. They're there to promote something, usually. Not always, but usually. And they're pretty transparent about that. Yeah. You know, it's usually part of the big joke is that, you know, the only reason I'm here is that they're making me be here because I'm promoting this new movie. And then part of that promotion is going and being on Jimmy. And, of course, Jimmy and Seth are thrilled that they have these great people right there in the building that are more than happy to go be on their shows as well because it's easy.
Have you ever had where, because obviously you go through a season, so you have a season like the church lady season, you know, where you have this, just one of the greatest seasons for me in my memories of Saturday Night Live. But do you ever have a season end where you're like, oh, that was such a good season. You know, what are we ready?
Yeah.
What's the next season going to be like? Or have you ever, has it been sad to see a season end or see a season start that?
There have been things. Although it's hard, I guess I've been there so long that it all blends together. The thing that stands out to me most is we had a kind of a bad patch in the late 90s where the show was kind of dipping in ratings and the show wasn't really doing well, and we were kind of almost dreading the shows. I mean, for the many years that I was a dresser, Saturday morning you go to do the show, and they have prepared, all the clothes have been prepared, and they're on a big show rack. So each actor has his space on this like rack that's as long as this whole wall. And each actor has his space. And under the actor's name, there'll be sub-labels, sub-little things holding separating the separators for each sketch that actor is in. And behind each of those are every piece of costume they wear for that sketch, all put together and prepared and ready to wear for them. So the actor's job, the wardrobe person's job, is to go find the papers, and each paper represents a sketch for that actor. So if that actor's in five sketches, you have five papers safety pinned together with your name on the top as their dresser, and then each page is filled out. This is for this actor. Say it's
Cowbell.
Or say it's for the Cowbell sketch. Right. And say it's Will Ferrell. So, and whoever was his dresser at the time, their name would be at the top. It'll say Will. And then it'll say Cowbell sketch. And then the Cowbell sketch, it'll say 1970s vintage shirt. It'll say 1970s vintage pants. Vintage belt. High-topped square-toed boots. Big chunky watch. It'll have, you know, medallion, neck medallion. It'll have everything that they have to wear. And, have I forgotten my thread here again?
Well, we were talking about that there's some seasons where there's just...
Oh, yes. I know what I was going to say. The whole point of my talking about that is we hit a patch for a long time that we had these pages, and they're pre-printed pages. They just pinned up, you know, hundreds of these pages with blank things. You know, actor's name, dresser's name, sketch name, costume pieces. Then at the bottom of this page, there were little boxes, and next to the box said vomit, blood, other. And we hit a patch where there was vomit and blood in almost every show, and two or three sketches in every show. Someone was throwing up, meaning throw up projectile vomiting all over every costume, every actor, every set piece, every prop, or there was blood spurting over every costume, every actor.
Does that save a skit? Some puke or some blood? Because I do remember, who was the chef lady? Just a flesh wound.
Oh, yes. Julia Child.
Julia Child.
It was Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be hysterically funny like that.
Absolutely.
But we had sketches where, and then when we do that, that means there's usually not time to wash and clean these costumes between when they wear them for the dress rehearsal at 3 p.m, then which we would then immediately say, well, then you can't use the real mushroom soup, gallons of mushroom soup gushing through a hose to pretend to be vomit, or the fake blood that stains everything, no matter how much the producer says it won't stain anything. We'll have them use water. But then we still, to get the effect of, oh, the hose is working and this is what it's going to be like. But then it's never really what it's like. And we still have to, like, dry and get the costumes ready for the 8 o'clock show. And then when we do it for the 8 o'clock show, then it's all out. And now we have to have it ready for the 11:30 show.
Jeez.
So it was always a pain in the ass. And then actors would slip and fall in it. And there were always problems with it. And it got so that they were kind of doing really cheesy writing and cheesy sketch. I remember there was one sketch and it was a car accident scene. And there was this whole big thing with broken cars. And there was supposed to be a mangled body. And the first policeman comes and looks at the body and starts throwing up. And then the next EMP comes and looks at the body and he starts throwing up. And then the next person comes along to take care of it and they start throwing up. And so every single cast member was throwing up all over everything. And oh, the whole thing was, and we did lots of sketches like that. And not that that was particularly involved in our the ratings dipping, but that was part of it. And the writing was just sort of dipping. And I remember it was right around that time. And there were a couple writers that we had that really focused on, that's kind of all they did. And I remember the beginning of the next season, just before the first show started, they called us all into a meeting in the studio. And it was Lauren there. And they had gotten rid of several actors and several writers. And I remember it was the first season of Will Ferrell came in. And
who was the chick that did the cheerleading with
that's him? And I know her really well. Sherry O'Terry, of course. Sherry O'Terry.
Classic.
They came in. They were new. Molly Shannon came in new. And they brought in this whole, the cheerleader sketches started. Molly Shannon she had actually come in at the very tail end of the year before and hadn't really had a chance to really get started doing stuff, but they already knew she was adorable. And, but that season, and I remember he had a meeting saying, the show is being close to being canceled. They are close to not renewing us, and we are physically going to do our best to, you know, bring some new life in and some new ideas and some new things. And they didn't dwell on the people that weren't there anymore, but they really kind of they were really kind of pushing this new blood, and with Sherry and Will and Molly, and I think there are a couple other new people.
Norm
McDonald.
Yeah.
Yeah. Norm might have been one of the new ones. Anna Gasteyer might have been one of the new ones. Anna was great, hysterical, and talented. She could sing. She's a super, super nice person. I just remember that transition of us kind of sliding into this thing where all the sketches were starting to be this. It was a very...
So that must have been after The Church Lady, because...
It was after. Oh, yeah. It was way after The Church Lady. Yeah.
The part of the issue with, I think, some of that was so funny, was so good.
And we couldn't, well, and if you just think of it, we had lots of sketches that really were, I think the whole point of the blood and vomit thing is that instead of being based on great, clever characters like Church Lady,
Dana Carvey,
like,
was so good.
You know, Gilda Radner's stuff.
Yeah.
That was, you know, she had every character of hers was gold. You know, the Emily Latella and, you know, all of her stuff was just amazing. That they had just kind of reverted to this, let's just shoot vomit all over the place and slip in it and think that's funny.
Well, one of the tough things about that whole, really, the Saturday Night Live's life is that you have Saturday Night Live and you have life around it changing so much. I mean,
yeah.
when Gilda Radner was on Saturday Night Live, we had probably seven channels, if not, right, exactly, if not five. Exactly. I'm not even sure, but I mean, it was, that was, I watched Rob Lowe was on a podcast, and he was talking about, he was on the worst rated show of networks back in like the 80s, and they had 19 million views. And that was the worst rated show on TV back then, 19 right, millions. Right. Where now, I think SDI or one of those, you know, investigative shows.
Right.
Is now, I think, the number one rated show, and it gets 8 million views.
Exactly.
So life changes, and Saturday Night Live is pretty much, you know, it comes on, two musical spots, crazy skits. You know, and then the finish. I mean, it hasn't changed much.
Yeah.
Well, except for the actors and life around it.
Yeah, they've really kind of handled the show brilliantly. I think that's Lorne's real ability to take the show that started in the 70s, that could easily be dated as hell. You know, could be like, there isn't any other show that has consistently been producing for over 40 years.
Well, that was my other kind of question was, there was a couple attempts, you know, we had Mad TV, we had,
right.
I don't even know, do you remember Fridays? I mean, Fridays
I remember
was,
Fridays, I remember SCTV, which was a kind of a Canadian version of Saturday Night Live. And they all had, like Mad TV had really good moments.
Mad
and
TV.
SCTV, which... You know, gave us Catherine O'Hara, Eugene Levy, all those wonderful
and Kramer,
actors.
Kramer was on Fridays.
Right,
Richard,
right.
What was his name? Richard, I forget his last name, but he was on, he used to do those little army men in the backyard.
Right.
So,
there was some really good stuff, but Saturday Night Live was just sort of, somehow it managed to get in there, sit down, take up space, and refuse to be moved, and it's just kind of worked, and it kind of helps that they have all along had, except for I think like that hesitation back that I was talking about, they have had like just unbridled support by the network.
Oh, yeah.
We have, as far as I know, I could be wrong because I am just a costume person, but as far as I know, every department, we don't have budgets.
Right.
We spend whatever we need to spend on the show, whatever they want to spend on the show.
Well, how bad could it get? It's an hour and a half. I mean, how much trouble can you get in?
Well, you'd be amazed.
I'm kidding. I'm joking.
I was going to say, I was talking earlier about Seth Meyers and Amy Poehler doing this Little Sleuth sketch. They produced it. The set was this big Victorian house. They did the sketch. We did it for the 8 o'clock show. After the 8 o'clock show, we would often go, and especially when I was dressing, when I really cared about, you know, what the transition's going to be, right. Because, you know, what would happen is you might not have any fast changes in the 8 o'clock show, and suddenly you have all your changes are fast changes because they've adjusted everything. They've shuffled sketches around. So we would just expectantly wait to hear what the cuts were and what the new show was going to be. And I remember waiting outside the studio just to hear what the cuts were. And sometimes I learned that sets would learn first because whatever sets were cut, they would start whisking out of the studio just to make extra room for the air show. And I remember the set designer coming out of the doors, passing me and saying, well, Little Sluice is cut. That's, what did he say? That's $100,000 worth of set we'll never see again.
Mm. Yeah.
One set for that show.
No, I think, and was it a big Victorian house? Because I think they used
big
it
Victorian
in
house.
Colonel Angus.
What was the interior? Colonel Angus was an exterior, as I remember. It was the front porch of the house.
So funny.
It's so funny. Oh, so funny. But that's, you know, and we have, as wardrobe, as far as I know, we have, they try and be sensible. But I remember... I don't think I'll get into trouble for saying this, but I know our designer, Tom Broker, who's done lots of other things, and he's really brilliant. And I remember going and they'd get fittings ready, especially if he'd have like a glamorous female host. And they'd be bringing in clothes for her and things for her to try on, if it's just contemporary clothes. And there'd be like a $6,000 contemporary evening, designer evening gown.
Wow.
And I would say, well, what is that for? There are no sketches where the host needs to have an evening gown. And it would, and someone said, he will sometimes just have the obviously gorgeous, expensive evening gown in there. And when the host would say, well, what's that for? He'd say, well, I thought we could cut off the skirt and you could wear it with jeans for a band intro. And we would do that. A $6,000 designer evening gown.
Wow.
And we constantly have $10,000 gowns, $20,000 gowns. It's
well,
amazing.
It is a show that has definitely hung in there. And there have been times I thought, this show might not make it. And I think we're probably on the same page. Because I'm sure, even though you work there, you have to be a little bit of a fan as well. So,
Oh, yeah.
So it's I don't want to, we're going to have to end it because we're past an hour. And I don't want to lose anybody on the podcast because this is all such great stuff. Maybe would you come back and do another one with me?
Sure, absolutely.
I'm just so thrilled that you came and hung out with me. I thought it sounded
like a ball. We could come back. I could talk about the Muppets if you want.
Well, and so we have nine podcasts. So my friend Tiffany does the film effect, and I was telling her because I thought maybe you could come and maybe talk about the Muppets Christmas Carol, wasn't
sure.
it?
Sure.
Because she does a film effect podcast. She just did the one for you have to look on the sky. I think it's a surfing movie, but she had Carlos on there. Maybe you can come and do a podcast with her. But I'd
like that. Sure.
I'd like to have you back on this podcast because I could talk to you all day. It's just a fun reminiscing about a great show. And you're just a costume guy. But honestly, between writers and costumes, there's not much else. It's a huge role.
Yeah, it is. And the show is really. I personally feel that that. The costumes are like the second most important thing in the show.
Absolutely.
You know, because the costumes are what wrap the actors. And so many of our actors will say, I didn't find the character until I had this costume on.
Well, and Dana Carvey's a great,
Exactly.
Doll, the doily thing around his neck that, you know, when he's the church leader. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah.
A half shirt on Will Ferrell. I mean, those are the most classic.
All those classic things.
Classic moments. So, yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it so much. And I'll have you back. You tell me when.
I'd love it. You tell me when you're ready, when people have, are...
Wednesday. No.
Oh, okay. Wednesday, sure.
No, we'll pace ourselves. But, well, real quick, are you going to go back to work?
I don't know. Again, I'm kind of going back and forth between this. Am I retired? Am I not retired? I was planning on doing the show. We did our March shows this past year, and I left to come down here to our place here in Delaware that I love, and I was planning to stay 10 days and then go back to do the April shows and then finish in May. And while I was here, everything shut down.
Yes, it did.
It all shut down. It worked out actually perfectly for me because I didn't have to flee the city suddenly. I didn't have to. I was just comfortably here and just went, oh, okay, I guess I'm staying here. There's been talk about will the show come back in the fall, and I haven't heard anything from my boss yet. I have been a little torn if he calls and says, will you come back? If I'll do that, I would love to on a basis of I really like it. I love the people. They're like my family. But the whole COVID thing and actually, I can't imagine them really coming back in the fall. Lauren is now 70-something. They're very loyal to their people. I mean, I'm not 20.
Right.
And there a lot of the people there are older. A lot have had some health conditions. The studio is like a windowless airplane. They were in the middle of 30 Rock on the 8th floor, and there are no windows. It's all recycled air. It's a small space. It was designed to be a radio studio. It wasn't designed to be a television studio. There's no space. We're all crammed in there. And I heard a rumor from one of the people I work with that they were maybe talking about trying to come back on a maybe a cutback crew, maybe no audience, maybe, you know, trying to do. And I thought, why? How would that work? Mm-hmm. You know, why bother if there's no audience, if the crew's cut back, then you can't do the show like it's usually done. And we're just going to have something that looks kind of like the things they did last year, which were admirable attempts, but it just isn't the same.
Well, and I think they were finding that with a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, I love golf. I watched Tiger play golf mm-hmm. yesterday. I love Tiger. Tiger had a presence about him.
Yeah.
You know, if you played with Tiger, you were going to play around 10,000 people.
Right.
The game changed when you played with Tiger.
Yeah.
You know, I watched basketball yesterday. They have, like, TV screens all around the court. You know, they're getting the game out.
Right.
They're getting the tournament out. We're doing, you know, Jimmy Fallon. I mean, he does this opening month, I guess this whole show, really, with no crowd.
Right.
And there
from his apartment.
Yeah, from his apartment. I think he's actually on the stage now.
Oh, he might be back on the stage.
I think they're doing something. But the point is that it, you know, it's like, here it is. I know it isn't exactly what we used to do, but we're doing it.
Yeah.
And you're like, eh.
Well, with shows like the Jimmy and the Tonight Show and even Seth, Late Night with Seth and Stephen Colbert, all those people, it was usually a host interviewing somebody anyway, you know, and wearing their suit, sitting at interviewing somebody, a little close, simple, intimate thing. If he's wearing his suit but in his apartment and he's interviewing somebody in their house, it's not the same thing, but it's pretty close. It's different than an entire cast of actors on a set wearing costumes under lights, doing a whole, you know, one different sketch after another one. It's just a whole different thing.
It's a different thing. I mean, when we were podcasting prior to all this and we were having a great time, and then this all started and we started doing the podcast through like Zoom meetings and you know, whatever they are. I was like, I'm not podcasting. I don't like, this is what I like, sitting across from a person, mm-hmm. and we are 6 feet apart, but this is what I enjoy. It's the, you know, the interaction with people. I'm not doing this over Zoom. I don't think that's not what I want to do.
Right.
And, you know, I can pick and choose, but there are businesses like the gym or Late Night Show and Saturday Night Live. I hope they figure it out. I think, is in a bit of trouble.
Yeah. Well, they're doing great in terms of handling the virus and not having a lot of sick people. Not their deaths are down. All that kind of stuff is great. It's just what they've hopefully temporarily given up to achieve that. Right. You know, people have learned that, oh, we don't necessarily need this expensive office in New York.
Right.
You know,
a lot of people figured that out.
A lot of people figure that out. Now, when everything goes back, because New York is just, it's New York. It's cool. It's exciting. It just is cool. When it all settles down and it's really safe, I think it'll all slowly just come back and it'll be back to where it was. But they're smart in that they're not in a hurry to do that. Right. And they're not going to try and push it for the sake, you know, of having more people and then having death rates and illness rates rise back up again. So, you know, good for them for that.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed. Doug, I appreciate it so much having you on the podcast today. I will have you back. We'll have you back.
Great.
We'll get you back here.
And, great.
Thank you.
It can be, it could just turn into Wednesdays and Thursdays with Doug, you know, and every Wednesday.
We could probably spend the next 50 years talking about Saturday Night Live.
We probably could. God knows I could, yeah.
Well, thank you for your service on the show. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
You're a big deal, so thank you so much. And like I said, we'll get you on Tiff's Film Effect and check out all of our podcasts on the Social Podcast Network. This is the Robo Social Podcast. This has been Doug James from Saturday Night Live. Costumer.
Yes.
Costumer. I like that.
Yeah.
Thank you again.
You're welcome.
All right, brother. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks. Bye.